Hello and welcome to Behind the News for February 21, 2009. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Two guests up this morning. First, in a few minutes, we'll hear from Pratap Chatterjee, author of the new book Halliburton's Army, about how contracting out makes it easier to go to war. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll talk with Susie Bright about sex and politics, too, which some serious types would have you believe has nothing to do with sex. Before proceeding, I want to say a few words in support of Joel Covell, the psychoanalyst and author who has been on this show several times, and who is the editor of Capitalism, Nature, and Socialism. He has been a professor at Bard College in upstate New York for about 20 years, and just a few days ago, the college informed him that they would not be renewing his contract next year. This is almost certainly a result of Covell's strong critiques of Israeli policy and his book Overcoming Zionism. This is an outrage for an institution that likes to present itself as quirky and edgy and bohemian and liberal. Bard College is behaving in a very orthodox manner by purging Joel Covell. So you can learn more about all this by visiting Covell's website, joelcovell.org. That's joelkovell.org. And if you are so moved, please write a letter, or an email rather, to the president of Bard College, Leon Botstein, at president@bard.edu, president@bard.edu. And now some comments on the economic news. Earlier this week, we learned that builders started construction on just 466,000 housing units in January at a seasonally adjusted annual rate, and just 347,000 single-family houses. These are both down by more than 50% over the year and are at record lows by a considerable margin. And those earlier records were set in the mid-1970s and early 1980s, when the American population was 25 to 30% lower than it is now. The single-family figure is down by more than 80% from its 2006 peak, which, by the way, was an all-time peak. This is by far the worst decline in the U.S. housing market since the 1930s. We don't have good enough stats from the 1930s to do meaningful comparisons, but my guess is that we're not at that dismal level yet, though who knows what the coming months might bring. The only bright spot in the housing report was that permits to build new houses, single and multi-unit, were down somewhat less than actual starts were, which is what usually happens as the market approaches a bottom. But permits are still at a horrendously low level. I doubt that the housing market will take off anytime soon, but historically, the U.S. business cycle has been led by housing in both recessions and recoveries. So my guess is that we can only start hoping for an end to this miserable recession, and I'm very sick of it and can't wait for it to end, I don't know about you. We can only hope for an end to this miserable recession when housing starts to turn. Another straw to grasp at, the Economic Cycles Research Institute's weekly leading index, which forecasts changes in the economy's direction 3 to 6 months out, is now falling at only a 16% annual rate, compared with 20% just 2 months ago. The best interpretation of this that I can come up with is that while things are still deteriorating, they're no longer deteriorating at an accelerating rate. And then there's the stimulus package, which should start kicking in pretty soon. For what it's worth, the Congressional Budget Office estimates that without the stim pack, we'd lose almost 4 million jobs this year. With it, they estimate we'll lose somewhere between 1.5 and 3 million instead. Averaging their low and high estimates, which is probably the safe thing to do, we could estimate that the stimulus will save about 1.6 million jobs. The CBO also projects that things would have picked up in 2010 without the help of the stimulus, though we wouldn't recover all the jobs lost until something like 2011. But with the stim pack, we'll gain almost 1 million more jobs next year than we would have without it. Translating all those numbers into simple English, you could say that while the job market is likely to stink through 2011, it will stink appreciably less because of the stimulus package. Let's hope the CBO is right. And finally, what about all these scandals? As if Bernie Madoff wasn't enough, now there's Alan Stanford. This time it was allegedly high-paying certificates of deposit, an investment vehicle that's not supposed to pay high returns, of course. Now, I normally don't get too worked up about corruption. I don't like moralizing, and I prefer my critiques to be systemic rather than individualistic. It's no accident, as the vulgar Marxists used to say, that among the biggest denouncers of corruption are hack apologists like Larry Kudlow. They love the pig system and think that high-profile malefactors should be punished for giving it a bad name and to set an example. That's not my style. But all this appears to be deeper than the word corruption alone would suggest. It seems like the whole society has gone rotten. To some degree, this is just the latest chapter in a long history of this sort of thing. This country was industrialized in the 19th century on watered stock and fraudulent bonds. Securities fraud is as American as apple pie and gun violence. And yes, this sort of thing is always exposed after a long bull market. During the speculative frenzy, critical faculties atrophy, and fraudsters enjoy a target-rich environment. When the bust comes, all is revealed. Or as Warren Buffett says, when the tide goes out, we learn who is swimming without trunks. Okay, yes, all true. But there's also some way in which 3 decades of neoliberalism, which have brought with them an intensified worship of money, have damaged people to the core. Margaret Thatcher said early in her reign that she didn't aim just to change economic policy, she aimed to change our souls, and it looks like she did. Apparently the SEC has known that something was fishy with Stanford for years, the same with Madoff before him, yet they did nothing. Was this corruption, bribery, self-censorship, complacency? Probably all of them. But this is a society badly in need of a renovation. In bad moments, I fear we're too far gone. In better moments, I hope we're not. Okay, let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk with Pratap Chatterjee. That was some of "And Tomorrow the Stock Exchange Will Be the Human Race" by McCarthy, a band named after Senator Joe. Pratap Chatterjee is certainly no stranger to KPFA listeners, so I'll keep this introduction short. The managing editor of Corp Watch and a KPFA producer, Chatterjee is the author of Halliburton's Army, How a Well-Connected Texas Oil Company Revolutionized the Way America Makes War, just out from Nation Books. To the public, the story the U.S. military is contracting out is, I think, mainly about Blackwater, now called Z, and its heavily armed, high-paid thugs. And insofar as there's a reason given for this turn to private contractors, it's usually attributed to cronyism and a search for easy profits. True enough, but Chatterjee's story is much more interesting. Contractors make it easier for the U.S. to go to war. Pratap Chatterjee. You open your book with an image of the kind of paradise of overconsumption. It's like they're translating the American shopping mall to Iraq. Tell us about that.
When you go to any base in Iraq, you, as a soldier, get to eat 4 times a day. You get to go to a mini mall where you can shop, you can order Pizza Hut, you can order Burger King, you can go to a place where you can buy Xboxes, there's a video games arcade where you can play Guitar Hero, you know, and you get all you can eat. And we're not talking meals ready to eat. We're talking about turkey, we're talking about Mongolian barbecues, we're talking about pumpkin pie, we're talking about 5 kinds of ice cream every single day, right? And of course, on Thanksgiving or Christmas, there's a lot more. But right now, if you're a soldier in Iraq, especially if you're on the bigger bases, this is, again, not true at the combat outpost level, but for the bulk of the soldiers, they actually live in a place where food is plentiful. The average soldier, when they go to Iraq and they come back 10 pounds heavier as opposed to, let's say, World War II or Vietnam, and they came back 15 pounds lighter. You don't have the gaunt soldiers returning. And remember, this is a volunteer army. In order to get people, soldiers, to go there, you can't just put them on KP duty, and you can't have them cleaning toilets, and you can't, you know, you can bark at them, you can get them to, you know, order them around, But you do have to treat them well. You have to treat them very differently. This is the 21st century. Kids expect, and these are kids, remember, these are, you know, 18 to 22-year-olds who are going out to war, a war they don't understand, in a country they can't find on a map. You've got to give them something, you know, a touch of home, as one of the public affairs officers told me.
From the Pentagon's point of view, I think you quote someone saying, you know, it costs us $100,000 to train one of these guys, spend an extra $6,000 to retain them, right?
That's correct. So Tim Horton, who actually is the next logistical officer, who's my public affairs officer in Anaconda, explained to me, these are ballpark estimates, but let's say it's $100,000 to train a soldier, and it's probably somewhere of that range. You know, if it's Navy SEAL or something, it's more like $2 million or $3 million. So you're spending all this money, you're sending that soldier over there, you want to make sure they stay. They have a tour of duty of 4 years, but they could extend that, you know. Or they could also go AWOL and disappear, as they did in Vietnam. You want to make sure that doesn't happen. So you want to keep them happy. These are mostly soldiers, the volunteers, come from poorer parts of America. And so if you assure them that they're going to get good food, you know, be able to do email and Skype, watch movies, go swimming and that sort of thing, then you're going to be able to reel them in, and you're going to be able to get them to go to war, right? Because when they go home, they have a very abject existence in some ways, you know. And of course, nowadays, of course, alcohol is not allowed in bases, so it's a little easier. And of course, they can't get out of the bases, so you can't get out. And it's not quite like Vietnam, where you went out and you had a hell of a time, and you picked up women, and you drank yourself silly. You've got them contained. You've got to keep them happy.
But of course, this is all made possible by a vast army of low-wage contract workers, right?
That's right. Halliburton's army is the people that make this happen. There are 300,000 people serving the U.S. military in Iraq. 150,000, 160,000 are soldiers. The rest are contractors. 50,000 of them work for what was once a subsidiary of Halliburton. It's called Kellogg Brown & Root, or KBR. And in the last 2 years, they've become a completely separate company. But they were once part of Halliburton until 2006, and have been since the 1960s. So this company hires people from India, the Philippines, Sri Lanka, Pakistan, Egypt, Palestine, and they come out here, and their job is to cook food for $300 a month, clean up. You know, if they're in Kuwait, it might be even less, it might be $100 a month. If they're cashiers, maybe they're getting $1,000 a month. So if they're a truck driver, maybe they're getting more. So these are the people that make it happen. The reason soldiers have turkey or apple pie or ice cream is because a Fijian drove this, you know, all the way from Kuwait, dodging bullets, you know, for $180 round trip. I mean, that's what this war is about. And so the soldier... There's a very good film actually called Someone Else's War by Lee Wang, who was a journalism student at UC Berkeley when she made it. And she describes the lives of these people. She goes into their houses and that sort of thing, and shows, you know, how these people have come from Manila or Fiji or whatever, or Nodia in West Bengal in India, to come work for the U.S. military.
This, of course, all this arose very much like in the broader economy. As, you know, the broader American economy is all about outsourcing. So this is all part of a military model, which is also part of a business model, right?
This is absolutely a business model. And the person who I think best summed it up was actually General Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense. And the day he did that was on September 10th, 2001, the day before the planes hit the Pentagon and the World Trade Center. He actually said he did this. There was a logistical conference that was happening at the Pentagon, and he said, we have an adversary. This adversary is, you know, more dangerous than, you know, any decrepit dictator, and it is the Pentagon bureaucracy. We have a problem. Things are expensive. And why are we doing this? Why are we mopping our own floors and cleaning our own dishes? We can outsource this just like every business does in America. When you go to Walmart, you buy things made in China. And he said, why shouldn't the Pentagon do that? He wasn't necessarily talking about weapons. He was talking about the mundane. Peter Singer, in his new book, talks about the jobs that are dull, dirty, and dangerous. And the dull and dirty jobs, he says, why should Americans do that? We can pay somebody else to do that. And that's effectively what's happened. So where in the first Gulf War, 1 in 100 people in the theater of operations was a contractor, now it's a 1-to-1 ratio. I mean, that's an astonishing leap. 100-fold increase percentage-wise of people that are contractors. And they're doing all the things that soldiers don't want to do. They're making it easier to go to war.
Of course, the popular imagination, this is all, you know, Dick Cheney and George Bush invented this sort of thing. But it is important to remember that Brown and Root goes back to LBJ, right? Tell us about Brown and Root and LBJ.
Well, Brown and Root, in fact, goes back even further back than LBJ, because they're building warships. There's a company called Brown Ship in the Second World War, where they're building warships. But really, they came into this logistical world in Vietnam when LBJ was president, and he sent them to Vietnam. There was a consortium called RMKBRJ, which is, you know, four different companies. But the lead company was Brown and Root, and their job was building the bases in Vietnam. So every base, you know, the airport in Saigon, you know, the bases in Nha Trang, all this was built by Brown and Root. And there's an amazing episode that I dug up. Actually, James Carter wrote a book called Inventing Vietnam, was one who actually tracked this down, where Donald Rumsfeld, in 1966, went to Vietnam. And he went on a little tour. And remember, Rumsfeld is a Republican. The president was LBJ, a Democrat. He went there to basically dig up dirt in what the Democrats were doing. It was just a standard political thing. He probably doesn't even remember this anymore. And when he got to Vietnam and he visited Cam Ranh Bay, he came back with a message for Congress. And he stood up in Congress and said, this company doesn't have receipts, there's an incredible amount of waste, and they're paying off the president. You know, this looks like war profiteering to me. So it's astonishing that 35 years later, that same man would say, why don't we hand these contracts over to Brown and Root, right? Because it's the very same company. The company that he claimed, you know, looked like it was involved in war profiteering. Suddenly, you know, of course, people change in 35 years. You know, and in between, he'd been a CEO. He ran NutraSweet, not NutraSweet, but Searle, the company, and had been a very successful businessman. He thought like a businessman. And he was Secretary of Defense twice, remember, again in the 1970s, I think, and then, of course, in 2001. When he came back, he had learned how to downsize, which is what he did at Searle. You know, he knew how to sell off businesses and units and make things work efficiently. And he was pretty ruthless about this. The funny thing is, Dick Cheney was a very bad businessman. Dick Cheney ran Halliburton, and he acquired a company called Kellogg, got them $1 billion in liability. Halliburton went into bankruptcy because of Dick Cheney. However, he did do a few things for them. One is the company didn't have a lot of military government contracts at the time. Since the heyday in Vietnam, they had actually, you know, kind of lost. They were no longer big in this business. They had $100 million worth of contracts in the 5 years before Dick Cheney came there. Suddenly went from $100 million to $2.3 billion. It expanded greatly. Some of it was to do with Dick Cheney and his Rolodex, and Thomas Cruickshank, who hired him, said, you know, we hired him because of the people he knows. You know, and they brought him in, not just the people in the military, the people he knew in the Middle East. Because remember, Dick Cheney was the man who sold, you know, the first Gulf War. He knew the princes in Saudi Arabia. He knew the people in Kuwait. You know, he knew the president of Azerbaijan. You know, and he was able to go in and say, hi, you know, I'm former Secretary of Defense. And, you know, presidents of Bangladesh, where he went, or people in Brazil would say, oh my God, the former Secretary of Defense. And he didn't actually have to be good at business. He simply had to walk in the door. And that's, you know, that's kind of what hiring a big name is like. So when Dick Cheney left Halliburton, in fact, Halliburton's lobbying business budget dropped by half. They didn't need to lobby anymore. The doors had been opened. I don't think Dick Cheney gave them the contract. I think Donald Rumsfeld gave them a contract. And in fact, there's a famous memo that Adam Zagrin at Time magazine dug up. And in this memo, it says, you know, VP has been informed, you know. And everybody saw this as a clue that Dick Cheney had authorized his contract. Doug Feith, in his book, actually says it's the opposite. He said, we informed Dick Cheney because he knew that this was going to be a public relations disaster. And he was like, that's okay, you can go ahead. And I believe him, because I interviewed the head of the Army Corps of Engineers when Halliburton first got its big contracts in Bosnia and that sort of thing. And I said, did you meet Dick Cheney? He's like, Dick Cheney? No, I've never met Dick Cheney in my life. I said, well, how did he get the contract? He said, well, there's a whole contracting system, and somebody like Dick Cheney himself doesn't do it. It's a lobbyist, you know, in a contracting office, and they talk to each other. But there's a system in place, you know, that is, you know, has been in the making since the Second World War, and particularly since Vietnam.
On the other hand, it seems, I recall one passage in the book where Halliburton wrote out a strategic plan and then got the contract. You're not supposed to do that. There was no competitive bidding. It looked like they had the inside deal.
Well, when you say they're not supposed to do that, it's because it's it sounds bad, it's unethical, but it's completely legal. So you're absolutely right. There was a point about 3 weeks before Iraq was invaded in which a group of people sat down, and notably Bunny Greenhouse, who became a very famous whistleblower later, and they made a plan for restoring Iraqi's oil facilities. In fact, the contract was called RIO, Restore Iraqi Oil. When they drew up the plan, you know, you had all these military people sitting down, people from Rumsfeld's office, the Army Corps of Engineers, and then in walks these two people from Halliburton, and they sit down at the table, and the woman who's in charge of the contract said, well, wait a second, what are people from Halliburton doing at this military meeting in the Pentagon? And they were actually the people who drew up the plan. Now, they drew up the plan, and you know, when you bid contracts, you don't normally have the person who drew up the plan bid on the contract, because they know exactly what's in that plan. And in fact, they know a lot of things that are kept secret from the bidders, right? So they understand the process. And the guy in charge was kind of a little annoyed that this had been brought up, and he said, you know, okay, we'll ask them to leave the room. But the thing is, when it was put out to bid, it was a no-bid contract. Now, the thing that people don't understand about the military is no-bid contracts are not illegal. In fact, they're quite common. There's a system by which contracts are bid. It's called the Federal Acquisition Regulations, FAR, and it's 2,000 pages long, very complicated. But one thing it says is in the case of a disaster or national security emergency, you can authorize a contract if the appropriate person in the military chain of command signs off on it. And so the SIGR, the Special Inspector General of Iraq Reconstruction, investigated this, you know, because there was so much of a brouhaha about this contract being illegal. And they looked at it, and their legal officer said, actually, you know what, this is a completely legal contract. It sounds terrible, but it's legal. It's okay to have a monopoly. Pentagon business rules allow you to do that. So was it, and again, there's a difference between what is legal and what is just. Let's not get hung up on the letter of the law. That's what lawyers do. That's what judges do. But we have to look beyond that.
I'm speaking with Pratap Chatterjee, who is the author of Halliburton's Army, just out from Nation Books. Now, one of the things that Halliburton was supposed to do was to get Iraq's oil running again. This is their specialty. They're known as an oil services company. This is their main line of business. They didn't really. Iraq's oil is running, but it's not anything like what it was. What took so long? Why have they been so unable to get the oil running again?
This is frankly one of the most bizarre stories that I came across. And I actually asked David Lessard, the CEO of Halliburton, and I was like, I don't get it. You guys invented, you know, a lot of the oil extraction technologies. You know, for example, offshore drilling. This is primarily something that Halliburton invented. Now, having said that, Earl Halliburton, who created Halliburton, sold a technology called oil well cementing, right? And that's how he made his fortune. Now, he stole that technology from a man called Perkins, whom he worked for. And this went to court, and he agreed, and he finally settled it out of court and paid the guy off. But since then, Halliburton has invented a lot of the very highly detailed, you know, GIS technologies that allows you to drill undersea. Why was it that Halliburton couldn't connect one set of pipelines to another set of pipelines across the river? Because that's what happened. In the Al Fatah crossing, Halliburton did a terrible job, you know, in plugging the oil fields in the south. The original job they were hired for was to put out Iraq's oil well fires. That actually took place quite efficiently. Mind you, Saddam Hussein didn't actually set many oil wells on fire, so it wasn't that big of a deal. But when they were asked to fix the entire oil system, they didn't do a very good job. And the key reason here is a system of accountability and oversight. Now, you could take the best company in the world and you could give them a bunch of money and say, do a great job. We trust you so much, we're not going to even check up on it. Well, most people, you know, would actually probably spend as much money as they could and try to do as little as possible in either the shortest or the longest period of time, depending on, you know, how they're being paid. If they're paid by the hour, the longest period of time. And it may not necessarily be a thing that they do intentionally, but when you know that nobody's looking at you, you know, you sleep a few more hours, you spend a little more on a fancy dinner.
And you're on a cost-plus contract.
You're on a cost-plus contract. Very, very important. For every penny you spend, every dollar you spend, you get 2 cents profit. Every $5 you spend, you get 10 cents profit, right? It doesn't really matter, the $5 and the $100, because that's all, you know, reimbursed. So in this particular case, part of the problem is the army said, we want you to run the pipes under the river so that they don't get bombed. Now, the river bed was actually very unstable. And the funny thing was, the reason the pipelines had been destroyed was because the Americans bombed them in the first place. So they said run it under the river. The geologist looked at it and said, this is not going to work. This is a very unstable riverbed. But the people in charge of the contract, the government people in charge of the contract, were like, do it now. We want this to happen in 6 weeks. We want to prove to the Iraqis we aren't here to steal their oil. We'll fix their oil system. And some of the Halliburton people said, this is not going to work. And they were like, we don't care. And unfortunately, because there was nobody talking to whistleblowers who said, this is not possible, nobody's saying, this is going to cost an awful lot of money, they went ahead and for, I forget it, I think it was 18 months, they kept trying to dig a tunnel under the river and it wouldn't work. It kept breaking. I was there, actually. I met some of the people in charge. They gave me this amazing DVD boasting about how this was going to be a feat of engineering that was unique. And the reason it was so unique is because it wasn't going to work, right? And it's this, and they, it was an internal DVD they gave me, and they were trying to get other people from the Army Corps of Engineers to come work in Iraq. And they said, you should check this out, because I was asking them, they said, this is just such a cool project. And I forgot about it until a couple of years later, T. Christian Miller, who was then in the Los Angeles Times, wrote this amazing story about how this underwater pipeline had failed. And I thought, wait a second, isn't that what they were telling me about Kirkuk? And I dug up the DVD, and I, you know, I was like, this is incredible. This unique feat of engineering was not actually that unique. In fact, it was impossible. And that's why it hadn't happened. But the fault here is not necessarily Halliburton's. It is actually the military's. And a lot of times the fault is with the military. And that, therefore with the people who pay the military, and that is the government and us, the taxpayers, we have not been watching the store. And maybe it's not you and me or the people that listen to the radio show, but it is very much the Pentagon bureaucracy. And partly it was, they went to war. They weren't expecting to run a country or to run all these bases. They thought they'd be in for 3 months and they'd come out. They had this wonderful war plan, you know, this logistical plan, you know, that, you know, came out of a manual. And they said, shock and awe, you know, we're going to go to war with this, you know, this dictator and we're going to beat him. Well, it's very easy to bomb a collapsed military to smithereens because they've already collapsed. Does that mean you can actually, you know, fight an asymmetrical war against people who know the country? Does that mean you can run a country, especially when they hire people incompetent? No. And that's exactly what happened. Halliburton should have been able to do it, but because nobody was watching them, nobody was actually listening to some of the people in Halliburton who were saying this is not going to work, people just kept spending money. You know, it's, in some ways it's very easy to spend money when nobody's actually bothering to check. This is not a Halliburton story, but there was an ex-con who was hired from North Carolina to go be a supervisor in Hilla in Iraq. Now, this man, when he showed up, they said, you're a supervisor? Okay, can you supervise the money? Well, now, the man was an ex-con, and nobody knew that. They gave him $82 million of Iraqi money, and they said, can you build us a new police station, et cetera, et cetera. The man, his name was Robert Stein, he hooked up with a friend of his, another American in Romania, Philip Bloom. They created a business. In 3 days, he wrote 6 contracts for $500,000. He bought machine guns, grenade launchers. He had a building with women, with which he provided sexual favors to other soldiers. He bought a Cessna. He bought a Lexus. He bought 18 gold watches. You know, he just went to town. And that's not the amazing part of the story. The amazing part of the story is he got a second contract in the same location from the U.S. Agency for International Development. Now, this is Iraqi. This is American money. And you actually have to fill out paperwork. You don't get paid unless you do the work. This ex-con, who's a thief, actually did a halfway decent job because somebody was actually checking up on him. So at the end of the day, they said, not a perfect engineering job, but it will do, right? In the case of the Iraqi money, he was asked to fix this library. He didn't buy any books. He was asked to fix the swimming pool. He didn't even bother, you know, cleaning the swimming pool. He just said, job is done. Collected, well, the cash that he had in his own safe, and he walked away. Now, the guy was caught. But, I mean, I think that's an amazing tale, that this ex-con, you know, working for a tribe in Montana, who has no idea who he is, who's sent, you know, to a remote part of Iraq, you know, who steals money, pays off his own fines that he owes the courts in North Carolina with that money, then does a halfway decent job because somebody was watching what he did. That, to me, is a very important government contracting lesson.
When you hear stories like this, and of course everyone's heard the stories of the many scandals that Halliburton and other contractors are involved in, you wonder, is this incompetence? Is this what you get with the public sector, you know, typical government work? Is this Dick Cheney's self-dealing? Is this part of a grand imperial design? How do you make sense of the lucrative for some, but incredibly botched task of managing Iraq?
Well, I think the answer is partly incompetence, partly nepotism, the revolving door. So they got the contract because they've always done these contracts, right? They were, in fact, the most qualified people to get the contract. They, however, since they were not being watched, you know, went to Iraq and did a bad job because they had, you know, incompetent people. They knew they were going to get paid. They didn't worry about it. Even though
they knew they would have no problem getting contracts in the future.
They knew they would have no problems getting contracts in the future. Even today, you know, Obama is not saying, I'm not going to give... Amy Goodman was telling me, she asked Obama, are you going to cancel the contracts? He said, no. The thing that he's saying is, I want better contracting. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. But here's the thing, and this is actually far more important than the incompetence and the botched, stuff, is that actually the contract has worked very well. And we go back to my initial point is, they've actually created Disneyland for soldiers. So even though there's been a lot of incompetence and a lot of waste, they now enable America to go to war without thinking about it. So even though they've spent money, people have died, they actually allow soldiers to sit there, you know, feed themselves, shop at mini malls, press buttons, kill Iraqis, and not really think about it.
Like press buttons and kill Iraqis or Afghans. So this is really greasing the chute for further adventures of this sort.
This is the problem with Halliburton's army and future war, right? When the thing that Donald Rumsfeld has invented, this, you know, this machinery by which you have drones that kill people, Indians that cook food and make it possible for Texas mechanics to service, you know, the unmanned aerial vehicles, is it allows the head of the Pentagon or the president to go to war wherever they want, whether it's Iran or Iraq, without even thinking about it. Because the human cost in American lives is relatively minimal. And the Americans who do die are contractors. They're not actually government servants. So it becomes a much easier task. So you have actually privatized the military, you know, not necessarily all the tasks. I mean, you have people like Blackwater guarding Paul Bremer and Dick Cheney and that sort of thing. But by and large, you have kids from Alabama who fly to Iraq, play a video game, and get fed, you know, McDonald's and Pizza Hut. You have transformed the way the U.S. can, in fact, expand an imperial adventure. And the question remains for the future, will a Bosnia or Kosovo or an Iraq or an Afghanistan happen again under an Obama? Well, he has the tools if he wants to do it.
And that was Pratap Chatterjee, author of Halliburton's Army, just out from Nation Books. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web, kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, the program behind the news. Let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk with Susie Bright. Sparks from 1983, I think. All you ever think about is sex. And no, that's not all I think about, and I'm sure you don't either. But we all think about it a lot, don't we? My next guest is someone who did a lot to revolutionize the way we think and talk about sex, Susie Bright. I love her for just that, but I also love her for her politics, my kind of far-left stuff. One of the founders of On Our Backs, the lesbian sex magazine that started publication in the mid-1980s, and one of the first people to show that feminism and raw sex could be good friends, Bright's latest book is X, The Erotic Treasury, just out from Chronicle Books. She's also got a blog, which is always worth checking out, at susiebright.com. Susie Bright. Welcome, Susie. You've got a new book, a very attractive fetish object almost, huh?
Oh, yes. I'm really thrilled with this because, you know, I've published so many geniuses over the years, but we so often are printed on cheap newsprint. People don't understand we're changing the world with our with our inadequate packaging. But this time, this is called X, The Erotic Treasury, and I implored, I went to a publisher that makes beautiful books, Chronicle Books, and I said, would you like to make something that is absolutely gorgeous and just, you know, filled with the riches of the best of erotic literature, but let's have it look like that on the outside. And we came up with, you know, not only a hardcover, but a slipcover and a die cut and brocade. And, you know, it was fun working with them. I've never had a publisher where I got to be part of a design process. You know, we'd make little maquettes, and you'd share fabric samples, and I felt like I not only got to be Susie Bright erotic guru, it was like brought in a whole Martha Stewart element that had never been part of my bookmaking before. I'm ready to take one of those classes where you do the letterpress. Anyway, it's gorgeous.
Which brings me in mind of everyone now seems to think the book is on its way to obsolescence, perhaps not as quickly as newspapers, but you haven't made the transition to a post-book life.
I actually have. I find that the two extremes of book life, the antiquarian, the small press, the carefully made limited edition, there's a tremendous amount of interest and a hunger for that part of the book world. And then on the other hand, you have the electronic book. When I heard about the Kindle.
Oh, yeah, you're a big fan of the Kindle,
yes,
aren't you?
Yes, and people keep saying, well, how much is Amazon paying you? I wish I could say one thin dime. They're not. It's just that when I heard about it, I was intrigued. I own the rights to a lot of my older titles that are, you know, pre-computer age works. And I decided to make some Kindle editions, and I realized I just couldn't do it without getting a Kindle and seeing if I even believed in it, you know, if I could get behind this new technology. And it was like catnip. It's so impulsive. You know, you open it up and you're kind of like, well, I think I'll get that. I mean, that's only 99 cents. Well, this is just a dollar. Well, okay, I'll splurge on that Eric Clapton autobiography. Like, things that I would not have bought in hardcover at the store, because I would have been like, no, it's too expensive for just a cheap thrill. Well, now you can have your cheap thrill.
Is the experience of reading them any different?
No. To be quite honest with you, the way you look at the page, the electronic page, I would say after about a minute, I forgot that I was reading anything other than a book. And, you know, my little finger would just press the next page button without even thinking about it. And you disappear into the reading experience. I mean, a lot of people asked me, you know, that when we first had computers, would anyone bother to read on the computer? I've always read on my laptop in bed. I'm constantly in bed with my laptop, much to my family's distress. Me, my pillow, my Mac Air, you know, we're just grooving away. But the Kindle is actually a more comfortable experience.
But before we move on, let's tell us what's in the Erotic Treasury here.
Oh, sure. Well, I approached a number of my favorite authors. We had to put almost all of our time into the production, and I needed people who could produce perfect, original erotic literature in a couple of weeks. I mean,
all the content's original?
Not all of it, but a great deal of it. And so, like, who is on that short list? What kind of people have the originality, the work ethic, the charm, the, you know, like, everything to pull that off? There's not a lot. I mean, luckily, I've been doing this for a couple decades, so, you know, I was determined to move through the Rolodex. But it was intense. A couple of people said, well, I have something that no one else will publish. I'm like, I'm intrigued. There's one story, Must Bite, and it's one of those Southern Florida stories that makes, like, Carl Hyacin would give him a run for his money. And it's about a guy who marries a stripper and welcomes her into his menagerie of exotic chimpanzees and apes, which she thinks is delightful and endearing in the beginning, but of course gets a little bit more complicated. It almost turns into a double indemnity kind of scheme. And I loved it. And when I first showed my editor, you know, the very thing the author worried about came up. They said, well, this is kind of scary. I mean, you know, sex, angry animals. I mean, do we want to go there? And I said, look, the reason you're squirming is because she's such a good writer. If it had been bad writing, you would have been, like, snoring. You wouldn't have even noticed. Second of all, clearly it's not a prescriptive story. It's a mixture of erotica and horror and suspense. It's, you know, Florida noir all the way. I don't know, sometimes when I work with new books and new publishers, one thing that's part of the education process is saying, if you just publish stories about perfectly nice people who take a walk on the beach and have delightful, warm, romantic sex afterwards, no one will want to read that.
But there does seem to be this problem where people have a harder time understanding that something is a fiction or a fantasy when sex is involved. Like, if there's crime or horror, you know, people can get their heads blown off. Somehow that's acceptable. But if there are somehow unacceptable sexual fantasies, then there's a whole lot of moral outrage vented.
Well, I think it's because our own ids are a little fragile, and sometimes if we haven't spent much time, you know, exposing our own imagination to the sunlight and having a laugh about it and realizing, you know, hey, you know, I may think this or imagine this, but I'm not in danger of falling off the cliff. If everyone had that kind of lightness and sense of a healthy relationship with their unconscious, perhaps people would be able to view sexual literature, cinema, you know, music, whatever, with a greater tolerance. As it is, repression, religion, you know, all the rest of it has people on a pretty tight string. Some of the stories in the book, for example, take a realistic view. I think the story I opened with is about a fellow who is perceived by those around him as a bit of a milquetoast. But his penchant, the kind of women he really turns on to, are what anyone would call broads. That's the name of the story. He likes, you know, kind of a brassy, gum-smacking waitress with a figure to match. You know,
but
like
he's got sensitive hands.
But he has sensitive hands, and he's always been ridiculed by his friends, and even his old girlfriend has said, "Well, you're never going to get a woman like that because they're going to look at you, and you're not going to be, you know, macho enough." As you can imagine, he gets a chance in an unexpected way. And that story is appealing to a lot of people who, you know, like, oh, if only, you know, I could be perceived for the person I am erotically. You know, if people, instead of looking at me, just saw, oh, you know, Mr. Nobody, you know, Mrs. Dowdy, if they understood the incredible sexual animal that lies within. And a lot of us have that notion, you know. So you'll have erotic authors coming at things from a lot of different perspectives.
And now I feel like a cliche for asking this question, but we're talking about books. But what has the internet done for sex writing?
Well, you know, take the sex out of that question and just ask, what has the internet done for writing? And you're going to get a pretty similar answer, which is that there really wouldn't be the kind of innovation in creative writing and topics that we see today without the internet. It used to be the small press, the underground press, the mimeograph machine served that function. I mean, when I started publishing underground literature, when I was doing On Our Backs, we were actually the first magazine to use any kind of desktop publishing, and I keep waiting for Steve Jobs to recognize me and give me a medal for that honor. But we were trying to figure out how one could afford to do something that was becoming quite pricey. I mean, everybody remembers when paperback novels, you know, opened up a flood of publishing that didn't exist until that point. People remember when underground newspapers were thriving. Again, it was affordable to a certain degree. Well, the internet changed those dynamics. And so for every person that ever knocked on a million publisher and agent doors and said, you know, I have something quite prescient here, I think you should take a look, and was like, yeah, come back when you shtuck Paris Hilton and we'll talk to you. You know, like, no one's interested. Well, some of those people really are the cutting edge. And because they've published on the internet, we have things that have transformed the publishing world. Earlier, before our interview, when we were just having some small talk, You mentioned the feminist blogosphere, and I said, well, you know, of course I have my pet peeves and my favorites, but thank God there is such a thing as a feminist blogosphere, because there wouldn't be any feminist publishing of any note without it. I mean, what are you supposed to say? Oh, Ms. Magazine is, you know, carrying the flag? Are you kidding me? There has to be an internet for the kind of political and cultural voices that are meaningful right now, or we wouldn't, I don't know, it would be pretty silent, alone in a brown paper bag.
I'm speaking with Susie Bright, who is, among many other things, the editor of a collection, X, The Erotic Treasury, just out from Chronicle Books. Bringing up a somewhat complicated topic, I'm sure there are a lot of the listeners who do not approve of pornography and do not see that feminism is compatible with
You're
pornography.
Right.
And someone who probably just about more than anyone else is responsible for bringing feminism and pornography together. What do you think the state of the struggle is? Is Andrea Dworkin, is her movement fading, gone? Is that kind of critique of pornography still have a lot of adherence? What do you think the state of that fight is?
Well, the word pornography is so abused and malleable, and I don't even know what people mean when they say it. I always have to say, wait, stop, back up. You know, what are we talking about here? If we're talking about...
It's Robert Jensen, it's all about the humiliation and degradation of women, right?
Yeah. Well, I find most of mainstream television would fit that description, but it's not necessarily sexually explicit. For me, when people... If somebody said, how do you feel about sexism in the media? How do you feel about stereotypes and exclusion and the narrow way that women's lives are presented in the popular media? Well, they're going to hear a very traditional, aching, demanding feminist critique from me, which it was the basis for how pornography started being critiqued. You know, it was sort of like one more thing that didn't have a female self-interest defined, in which women's interests and prerogative and imagination was difficult to find. So there's never going to be a day when you're going to, you know, turn on Fox News or open the, you know, a daily paper and say, wow, I feel so well represented. Social justice is really making me happy today. You know, like, that's not happening. But the idea of, I guess I'd call it picking on sexually explicit materials as being like the worst actor in this, or, you know, some special site of unbelievable humiliation and violence, is ludicrous if you knew the slightest thing of what you were talking about. Sometimes people ask me, well, what do you think about the commercial porn scene today? Like, let's zero in on, you know, what's pumping out of San Fernando Valley. You know, like, let's talk about that industry in particular. And I would say the same thing I would say about Hollywood, which is that creatively it's a dead zone. There's nothing new happening. There are no auteurs who are, you know, blowing your mind. We are not in a high creative state. When people get nostalgic about the amazing Hollywood cinema that was coming out in the 70s, actually it was about the same time that porn was in its golden age as well. It's like we're all feeling nostalgic. The exciting work that's being done with sex in cinema right now is by independent artists who are not going through the rating system at all. Some of those, you know, we're seeing at repertory theaters, film festival circuits, and so on. It's exciting. You know, whenever I get a whiff of one of them and people say, wow, you know, is there actual sex? Well, yeah, the director is just treating sexual experience as one more part of their palette. They're just doing what would one would do naturally if you weren't worried about a ratings board. You know, you would say, yeah, we're going to show the relationship turn. There's going to be a pivot here, and it's going to happen while they're having sex. You certainly can show things in a relationship when sex is going on that, you know, are a very intimate, real view. Why not get to those places? More and more people are doing it. It's really a question, and some of them are brilliant at it. You know, we look at them and go, wow, is that what could be done? You know, like, these are the next steps I want to take. But unfortunately, you know, when we see what's nominated for Oscars, or what you see what's nominated for the best porn picture of the year, you're going to see a really, the parade of banality is pretty extreme right now. So there I am. There's my 2009 catch-up.
I was lamenting the fact that before I hit the record button that there are no good Republican sex scandals around to talk about right now. But I'm sure it's only a matter of time,
yes.
And there's certainly been plenty. But what is your theory of why these guys end up diapered or in bouncing their feet in toilet stalls or, you know, it's a long list of very strange things. What is it with these guys?
It's a wide stance, isn't it? It covers so much. I honestly believe if we put down the mic and checked your browser, something may have happened since we began our interview. They seem to be cascading. And finally, the media is, and really this is again an internet phenomenon, is lost its shyness about pouring some sunshine on the subject. I wish there was even more. The fact that Vitter and Craig are still part of the Senate, you know, that there's this endless parade of people who seem to really not suffer any consequences, that, you know, get to stay in the old boys club unperturbed. Now they're leading the fight against the stimulus bills, and you wonder, how is anyone supposed to listen to them with a straight face? I mean, the cognitive dissonance is like this giant mawing gap that, you know, you keep thinking, we're going to get sucked in. It's a vacuum. I personally, you know, I always like to set up my betting pools on who's going to fall in next. I had a betting pool on when Ted Haggard was going to, you know, get busted in another lie, another disgrace, and he recently was. You know, it turned out it wasn't just one lonely hooker and one solitary methamphetamine deal. No, Ted's been so busy, you know, making plastic dildos in his own image and, you know, courting his parishioners. There was him. I think that Rick Warren is looking like a very large, fat target for someone who's, you know, charlatanesque campaign. It's just like, ouch. You know, the bigger they get, the harder they fall. When someone's hubris gets to this level, you know, the kind of promises, the sweeping pronouncements they make, building a life and a campaign on humiliating somebody else, you know, and making a display, in his case, you know, gay marriage and, you know, the gay relationship and all that crap about loving homosexuals while he condemns them. This guy is setting up for a really big fall. I can never guess, though. People say, well, what compromised position do you think they'll be in? And I say, I don't know, because truth is always stranger than fiction. You could not have predicted David Vitter in a diaper fetish. You couldn't have. I mean, I defy anyone. Jeff Gannon, male whore doing marine domination fantasies, ends up being in the White House press corps, getting to ask questions. You can't make this stuff up. There's so much more of it. Karl Rove's dad is one of the leading lights of the Leatherman piercing trends. I mean, like, I'm sorry. My mind boggles.
Well, whenever one of these guys gets exposed, so to speak, you always wonder, is this hypocrisy? That's the common explanation.
Mm-hmm.
But is it actually something more profound than that? Is there actually some relation between that level of sexual repression or closeted living and the politics these guys represent?
Well, I know where you're going, and I do have one thought about this, which is I do think it is a very conscious mark of their elitism and their anti-democratic impulses in politics. They really do believe that moral rules and any kind of rules are for other people. They're for the little people. They're for the people who can't handle the power, can't handle. They're special. They're VIPs. Yes, they do this, they do that, they bugger this person and that person, but they are unique. And little people can't be expected to understand that. This is the same thing the Vatican, you know, is famous for. They have the largest pornography collection in the world going back centuries because they wanted to have a copy of everything because they're special. They're the only ones who can understand it. They're the only ones who know how to handle these materials. And when you have that attitude, which goes against everything about the Constitution or our ideas of American democracy, that there's one set of rules for, you know, ordinary people, and then there's us, and we can do whatever we want because we're chosen, we're unique, our wealth and our power has defined us separately from others, and, you know, you get to have these sort of Cheney-esque flights of fancy where, you know, anything goes. So I often, when I talk to people who don't see the point in why sexual politics is, you know, important, why it's not just a joke or a frivolity, I say because sexual speech and sexual liberation is so close to the heart of democracy, and it's one of the first kind of sanctions and things that people use to create a wedge. Like, we're going to make an exception here. You know, we're going to abridge our Constitution here. We're going to say that I'm okay, you're okay, you're not, you know, special differences. We're going to do it around sex because sex is so extraordinary and bizarre that we can make these rationalizations. So when you want to look at the slippery slope, you're going to find sex right there at the beginning, and that's where these fellows begin.
And finally, we're just about out of time, but what does economic crisis do to sex?
God. Well, do we want to answer that personally or on a greater scale? I've been hearing a lot of, you know, some people are saying, you know, our sex toys and sexual entertainment and, you know, sexual flights of fancy, is that going to be the Shirley Temple of this depression? I mean, is that going to be one of the things like drinking hard liquor, you know, the sales will persist, you know, no matter what? Or are we in a malaise? Are we in a funk? I find myself arguing both positions. I definitely do see a kind of people turning closer to friends, family, community, looking for their own resources to enjoy themselves, and that certainly includes sex. You know, like, hey, I'm not going to be a consumer, you know, just sitting back waiting, you know, to buy my next experience. I'm going to make it happen for myself. On the other hand, I'll find myself talking about what the pharmaceutical industry has done to millions of American sex drives, a sense of malaise, of helplessness, a kind of depression that I think is commonplace in American society, and you often see it affecting people's libidos. We certainly have a younger generation that is delaying sex later. I don't know, you know, you can blame it on a million things, but
I noticed one of the stories, actually your story in that collection, right, where you say something like 32 is the new 13.
32 is the new 13, baby. They are just coming out of their egg. I mean, you've seen this recently. Somebody finally had the nerve to publish it in the New York Times and said, for all the hue and cry and adults imagining that teenagers are having rainbow parties and orgies in the back of the school bus, sorry, that's your little fantasy. That's not what's happening. They're more conservative. They are delaying sex. Sexual experiences and maturity that we used to think were part of late adolescence are now happening in the 20s. Everything is sort of like pushing ahead a decade, and that's having a profound effect.
So we need yet another sexual revolution, don't we?
Oh, gosh. I know. Where's my combat boots?
And that was Susie Bright, editor of X, The Erotic Treasury, a book as beautiful as it is hot, just out from Chronicle Books. Check out her blog at susiebright.com. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. I'll be back next week. As I said a week ago, I'm no fan of the Grateful Dead. If only I'd thought of making that point musically last Saturday, but it's never too late. Here are the Teen Idols doing Deadhead from the great compilation 20 Years of Discord Records. Till next week, bye.